everyone, you are tuned in for another episode of Getting to the Root of It with Venus Roots, aka me, your host. And before we start the conversation today and today's episode, it's been really hard to move through the sort of devastating daily news coming out of Palestine. In the moment that we're recording this episode, we're at 180 days of the genocide on the Palestinian people. And, you know, today's conversation is really situated in Quwa, another, you know, place and region that has sort of resisted against the U.S. hegemony. And I'm excited for today's conversation. I'm excited to learn, and I'm excited for us to sort of dispel some myths about Quwa. That's always a favorite topic. But without further ado, I want to welcome my guest today, Dr. Samira Audrey, who is an alumni of ELAM. And for folks who don't know what ELAM is, it's the Latin American Medical School in Quwa. Welcome to the show, Samira.
Right on. Thank you, Nikki. It's a pleasure to be on. The Latin American School of Medicine in Cuba, and its abbreviation in Spanish is ELAM, La Escuela Latinoamericana de Medicina en Cuba. So that's what we always call ELAM. ELAM, if you are going to hear us, you know, talking about the school, we'll refer to it that way to make it easy.
Yes. Thank you for being on the show today. You know, I think the first time I heard about the school was probably the first time I went to Quwa, which this was back in the Obama days where, you know, a bunch of Americans started, you know, sort of pouring into the island. And I grew up in Miami, so I grew up with a lot of sort of narratives around Quwa and what it's like. But at the same time, I'm Puerto Rican, so, you know, I think we have a very close relationship with the islands, and we also have a really close relationship of understanding how colonialism works and the sort of stories and myths it creates around that. So I guess for context, just to get us started, can you give people a little bit of just like an intro, right? Like, well, how did this school start? We know that Castro started it and that it was part of a sort of social program, but yeah, like situate us a little bit. How did this start?
So ELAM was inaugurated in 1999. This was a school that was created by Comandante en Jefe, Fidel Castro, because a year before, in 1998, Hurricanes Georges and Mitch had ravaged parts of the Caribbean and Central America, leaving, you know, devastating losses, casualties, and infrastructural loss. And and I'll go backwards. I'm going to start tell the story backwards. So in the midst of this disaster that affected so many people, Quwa sent a contingent of medical professionals to the affected countries, and they were supposed to help, you know, take care of the sick and injured. And they were there for some time, but they realized that their stay was only a temporary solution to a much bigger problem, what Comandante deemed the hurricane of poverty that was devastating those countries for centuries before and through several cycles of different hurricanes, right, and natural disasters. That hurricane of poverty had left thousands of communities without any kind of health infrastructure and access to healthcare. And so being that Cuban professionals will only be there for such a short time, he was trying to find a more permanent solution to the problem that his personnel were witnessing and commenting about. And so he thought of the idea of training the youths from those communities, those poor and disadvantaged communities, so that they would become physicians. And then they would return to their communities and become that permanent embodiment of health care within their people. And so this school the idea of the school was birthed. They transformed a naval base in Havana, off on the outskirts of Havana, into the medical school. It's a huge site. And this is a school where they ended up initially giving about 5,000, promising 5,000 scholarships to the countries that were first primarily affected by Hurricanes George and Mitch. And then as people heard about it, more and more countries solicited these scholarships for their youth as well. And so in that first year of school, by then there were about 18 countries represented, with I think over 6,000 students to start with. And it just grew. The school grew. Its reputation grew. The need was always there because, as you know, unfortunately, part of the legacy of colonialism, neocolonialism, imperialism has left much of the world without proper infrastructure when it comes to global healthcare. So the demand was high for this opportunity to be shared with other people from different parts of the world. And what ended up happening is now we are going into our 25th year anniversary of this school this November, November 15th, 25 years. And it has graduated over 30,878 physicians from every continent you can think of, Africa, Latin America, South America, Central America, the Oceania region, Asia, the Middle East. You were just talking about Palestine. There have been thousands of Palestinians who have, over the years, been educated at Elam. And currently there are a few hundred that are currently studying in Cuba. And this is the tail end of a long legacy that Cuba has always had since, you know, the triumph of the revolution in 1959. It really sealed its commitment to helping its neighbors in the world through this kind of constant sharing, sharing of knowledge, sharing of human resources for the sake of, you know, the betterment of the world. And so this school has students that represent over 120 countries. It is a truly international school. I don't think there's anything comparable to it anywhere else in the world. And it has a very unique mission, which speaks to the larger commitment that Cuba has to global health, which is to train doctors of science and conscience that will, you know, be part of their communities, help and guard their community's health, guide them to solutions that are relevant to their particular culture and particular situation. And I think that is part of the unique aspect of the school, is that you go there knowing that this is a global force that is being created here. It's not for just people who will isolate themselves, but to also build a global mindset in each student that comes out of there, to know that they are part of a broader community. There's an interconnectedness that is very present within us as we study, and we realize that, wow, we may have, you know, distinct cultures and practices, but we also have similar goals and needs that we can all help to fulfill, right? So if my comrades from Togo call on me and say, we have a situation, we need, you know, all hands on deck, I'm going to go. If my friends from Peru said they need help, I'm going to go. Or Solomon Islands, you know, like, we just learned that we were all we had, and we needed to keep ourselves sharp. We needed to learn the medicine, not only in the classroom, but outside of those walls of the institution within the Society of Cuba, in order to be good representatives of our people within that school, And also just in the world, because we owe a debt to each other. And it was a profound transformative experience for me. But that school has a beautiful history, and I hope more and more people get to learn about it and know that it is a viable choice in a world that you have many choices, but you can be led by certain values to dedicate yourself to studying in Cuba if that's what you want.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sort of like just grounding us. I think there's a few questions that come to mind. I mean, I think in this moment, on one end, I think, especially, you know, being 4 years into the COVID pandemic, I think Americans we've really had to reckon with the reality of healthcare in this country and the lack of and the inaccessibility and, you know, how gross it is to know that it's truly just a profit-driven industry in this country. I think from 2020 to this day, so many people have had to reckon and sort of awaken to that reality. So I think that's something, you know, in the atmosphere I think people are dealing with and thinking about. I think, you know, also to think about Palestine again, like so many people are thinking, also seeing the attacks on healthcare workers on Palestine, attacks on hospitals. So this idea of healthcare and health and whose lives are worth, you know, saving, I think are on a lot of people's minds, which is why I was also really excited to have this conversation with you today. But also everything you're saying is also situated in the reality of the U.S. blockade on Cuba, right? And it feels almost impossible to talk about anything relating Cuba without talking about the blockade. And, you know, I think people are maybe familiar with it to different extents, but I think for me, what's really impressive beyond everything you already said is, you know, how despite the fact that Cuba is under the history's longest embargo and by a very powerful force, you know, like the U.S., the empire, that despite that, it has still managed to educate what, in, you know, the international community deems as some of the world's best doctors. And despite the blockade, it's also been able to, you know, to your point, dispatch these incredible doctors with commitment to human life and, you know, and protecting life to all different corners of the world. And I think one image that comes to mind, you know, we typically think of the global south, of course, and but, you know, I remember early pandemic, early lockdown, that first month, those first weeks, seeing that image of those Cuban doctors arriving to Italy, right? A European country. And something about that shocked a lot of people, right? Like Cuban doctors arriving to a European country because there was a shortage of doctors and the country was in crisis. So I'm saying all of that to say, it's a sort of like, a share my sort of like, I like thinking around like what that means, what it means of that triumph of, you know, Cuba's dedication and commitment to education, to healthcare, to medicine. So I guess from there, you know, what comes to mind around the blockade, of course, and how you all have had to, you know, also you as a healthcare professional have had to sort of navigate those realities. But despite that, y'all have also been able to have so many advances and also, you know, have so many commitments to the international community at the same time.
I mean, you really said a lot and spoke a lot of truth. And to touch on this point, I also have to clarify something, because part of this long history, when I say the llama is on the tail end, is because Cuba started this whole idea of medical internationalism as early as 1960. You know, that was shortly after the triumphs of the revolution, and it was already sending folks down to Chile in 1960 to help after an earthquake. Then it helped send people down to Algeria in 1961, because they were going through their liberation struggle, trying to fight off the French. And subsequently in other African countries. They sent medical professionals to Guinea-Bissau, Angola. I mean, you name it, Cuba was there. And initially it was, you know, a military and a medical mission that would always be sent down to these different places because of the reality being that these people were literally fighting for their freedom, right? But aside from those instances of participating and aiding in liberation struggles, very far from home, in places they had never been to, encountering cultures and languages they had never been exposed to, but all the same being committed to the fact that I am my brother's keeper, like Patria es humanidad, the famous quote by Jose Marti, is the reason why they were out there in the jungles where they needed to be. And not only that, they would go out, like I said, after disasters, whether it was an earthquake, some of the more recent examples. And you may know about their offer to help the United States after Hurricane Katrina, when George Bush was president. And this is actually also dovetails with the fact that I had learned about Elam when I was 15. I think I was in about to be a sophomore in high school. And so my plan was to, you know, finish high school, take the college courses that I needed, and then apply directly into the program. But George Bush was president when I graduated high school, and he was very hostile to Cuba. His policies were very hostile, and he was at that point threatening the mobility of U.S. medical students between countries, although they were supposed to be exempt from any of these restrictions regarding travel to Cuba. But they wanted to pick at, you know, this one good thing that was happening for the U.S. side of things. They wanted to just strip us of our agency, right? So at that point, the program had to halt accepting applications. But Hurricane Katrina happened when I was in high school. And when it happened, shortly after Cuba offered to send medical personnel to set up field hospitals to you know, help the people, they mobilized over 1,500 physicians and nurses and health technicians. And that whole group of a contingent was then also named the Henry Reef Brigade, specifically to honor Henry Reef, who happened to be a U.S. Soldier who fought on the side of Cubans during their war against the Spanish. And this contingent was then supposed to, you know, go to Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, the areas affected, and help. And in that situation, that contingent was housed. It so happened that they ended up being housed at Elam, at the campus of Elam, waiting for their orders. They had their supplies packed and everything, waiting for the offer to be accepted in order to be flown out of the country. And some of their training, their cultural sensitivity training, they even asked, you know, U.S. Elam students to help them get to know a little bit more about the areas that they were about to go to, what people were like and what they were going to encounter, which shows, you know, the kind of work that Cubans do. They don't just go into a place assuming they know everything. They consult people from, you know, the midst of that culture to really assess their knowledge and prepare themselves before they go, as much as possible, right? And the fact that they had U.S. students on that campus, they took advantage and they said, yeah, why not? You guys tell us what it's like, you know, to be in Mississippi, Louisiana, and in Alabama. What should we expect when we get there? They did all of that, and the offer was rejected. George Bush decided that whatever political agenda he had was more important than sending qualified professionals to help on the ground. What he decided was to send the National Guard, and we saw how that played out in real time. I'm sure the footage, people who are younger, you can probably go on YouTube and see the footage of what National Guard was doing on the ground to help the people, right? So this is a moment where you say, a catastrophe has hit my neighbor. What can I do to help? You're immediately mobilizing your people, you know, who also have to leave their loved ones in order to make these missions, but they're ready. And despite all of that, we get a flat out no from an administration that could care less about the livelihoods of the poor people who were sacrificed due to that disaster, who were displaced due to that disaster for many years. The residual effects of that disaster lived on for years afterwards, to this day, right? And there are some people who've never even been able to return to their homes because of how they were pushed out, essentially. But to center the issue of health and protecting people's health and prioritizing their needs is really what Cuba was about. So Cuba offered that and it got rejected, but it didn't stop there. The Henry Reef Brigade was then mobilized to go to Pakistan because there was an earthquake, to go to Guatemala because there was an earthquake, all in 2005. And so while they were not utilized in the United States, they were sent to other places. Other places, Pakistan was a completely different terrain. They went into the mountainous areas. It was winter. It was cold. You know, Cuba, super hot, you know, Caribbean tropical island. And these people have to now brace the snow of the mountains in Pakistan in order to help people who have been destroyed by that earthquake, you know. But they did it, and they stayed there for months. They stayed there for months, and then they came back. And after that, the Henry Brigade took off as a bigger, more permanent manifestation of what Cuba had always been doing in decades before. This became the entity or the group that served a purpose of continuous medical missions from 2005 to present day. And when you talk about 2020 and these missions, the brigades that were sent on mission to Italy, the Lombardy region, and so many countries in the world, it's from the Henry Reef Brigade to new places and also to places that they had already established medical missions in. Because Cuba is a sort of country that doesn't just fly in and fly out. It's not the, you know, that typical humanitarian mode that we are used to, where NGOs go to a place for a moment and then they disappear after a few weeks or a few months. No, that's not what Cuba does. Cuba goes to a place, assesses the situation. If it can set up a base of medical professionals to help the community, it stays. If it can help to set up a faculty of medicine, it stays. And because of that, between 1963 and 2004, alone, Cuba was able to set up at least 9 medical faculties in different countries. In Yemen, in Guyana, in Gambia, Ghana, you name it. Those countries now have medical faculties of their own because Cubans decided to stay and help build an infrastructure for them that would be there on in their own country so that they can train their youth without having to fly to Cuba to study, right? These are things that we don't get to learn about or find out about. And most of this for a long time was out of the pockets of Cuba, of the Cuban Revolutionary Government. This was footed by the Cuban Revolutionary Government. In the case of, in the latter end of history, or more recent times, we should say, with everything that happened, the fall of the USSR, going through the special period, things had to be then adjusted. Economically speaking, where if there was a country that could pay for these medical collaborations to stay in their country, they would pay. Key example is South Africa. South Africa knew what Cuba had done for them in helping them fight apartheid and bring down, you know, the apartheid regime and win their liberation. But not only that, Cuba started to educate its youth, training them in medicine and other professions in Cuba. But then it also got to a point where they started to establish themselves within South Africa to be able to work in the rural parts of South Africa in the interim that they were training these young people to come back and serve in their country. And this is something that South Africa pays for because South Africa has an economy that is able to sustain that bill, right? So that's also a way that Cuba now finds itself trying to survive this blockade, which you raised, which is a huge factor in just the daily life of Cuba. The blockade impacts so much, and most of our people do not know what the blockade is, what the embargo is. Some people want to call it the embargo. We like to call it a blockade, because if you really think about it, Cuba has been cornered in a way to isolate it completely from any kind of commercial and financial transaction, any kind of economic life, which would dictate, you know, how things or how projects thrive in that country. Right? This is a country that's promising its people guaranteed housing, guaranteed education, guaranteed healthcare, jobs, all of this and food, basic supplies subsidized by the government. And for them to be able to do that, they need income. And what the United States decided to do since 1960 was strip them at any avenue possible of getting their hands on sustainable income, and also being able to use whatever income they do have to make transactions that will help keep their socialist project alive. So, you know, in 2 days, we'll see anniversary of the Mallory Memorandum that came out April 6th, 1960, and it was declassified in 1991. And this is a memorandum that explicitly made it clear that the United States government was going to do everything possible to cause desperation and the overthrow of the revolutionary government. They were going to make sure they were going to make everyday living for Cubans hell in order to make a point that Cuba could not be in the nose of the empire, a socialist project, and get away with it. And it has, you know, it was one thing when we had the USSR to shoulder some of that bullying that was happening. But once the Soviet bloc fell, who did Cuba have? And Cuba realized before the Soviet bloc fell that it didn't have much anybody except themselves, and that it had to support itself in different ways if it was going to survive, right? So what happened? After the Soviet Union fell and Cuba was on its own, it now has to face the full brunt of these measures, where you have the Helms-Burton Act, the Torricelli Act, 1991, 1992, 1994. These people in Congress decide that all they're going to be focused on is setting up legislative policies that clamp down on Cuba's ability to do anything, such as shipping companies not being able to, you know, dock at nearby ports or U.S. ports if they choose to deliver to Cuba. And they can't dock at U.S. ports for 180 days, 6 months. You just said the genocide been going on for 6 months. Think of a shipping company that's supposed to deliver maybe soap for a population of people being penalized from docking in nearby ports. And we know nearby ports around Cuba are going to be U.S. ports. Who else is going to own these ports? They can't dock anywhere for 6 months, which means those shipping companies are less inclined to deliver to the people of Cuba. And if they do, it comes at a hard and high price, right? And a poor nation that is doing everything it can to just get, you know, its pennies in its coffers now has to pay exorbitant prices for these kind of basic goods to be delivered. And everything comes by shipping. Cuba has to import about 80% of its food. Then also fuel. And the fuel aspect is what at present is more infuriating, because what happened after the Soviet Union fell was, well, Cuba wasn't going to get oil from Russia and the Soviet countries anymore. Who was going to bring the oil? So Cuba went into what we call the special period, where fuel wasn't coming in, which meant electricity was down, water pumps weren't working. Everything runs on fuel, whether we know it or not, right? So many of the machines, the heavy industrialization machines, run on fuel. And so if you don't have that coming into your country, it paralyzes you. And this is what happened during the special period, and it immobilized so much of life, but Cubans persisted. They were bent on surviving and making a way out of no way, and hay que resolver, hay que inventar, hay que hacer lo que tiene que hacer para sobrevivir. And that's what they did during the special period. And the great thing about it is that there were human beings in the world who also cared about Cuba enough to know that what was happening was unjust, and that if anything, we could also contribute in some ways of solidarity. We could give what we could to support Cuba in these hard times, right? And that is, you know, the birth of solidarity activism that had long been in place, well, since the 60s in the United States, especially in terms of the leftist circles, but it deepened during those periods of crisis, because solidarity movements and organizations started to ramp up their activities. In our case, IFCO Passes for Peace started the Passes for Peace caravans that would take humanitarian aid and would take people to go see Cuba for themselves and learn about Cuba and also share what they have and understand that the U.S. people and the Cuban people have a lot to share and a lot in common. And the government of the United States is going contrary to what the people of the United States want, right? So the stories of, you know, humanity helping to fight back these injustices really flourishes when you think about the Cuban story. And after the special period when, you know, Hugo Chavez, Comandante Chavez became president of Venezuela, that was like a breath of fresh air for Cuba, because now it also had a strong ally that could contribute a lot of that oil that it needed, which led to an incredible collaboration between Venezuela and Cuba. You know, oil for food, oil for doctors, just things that really upped the quality of living after so many decades of struggle by themselves, right? And the clear-eyed vision of Comandante Chavez in supporting the Cuban Revolution and also supporting the liberation of entire Latin America from this neo-colonial and imperial power that is the United States is what led to creating other avenues, ALBA, just creating a space where we could say, as people of the global south, yeah, we understand that you're our neighbor, U.S., but you don't get to dictate everything that we want to do. We also have to care for ourselves in the way that we want to care for ourselves. And we see our sister nation, Cuba, struggling and standing there for us in hard times. We also want to stand with her in hard times, right? And so that policy and those actions from Venezuela, from Brazil, from other nations in the region, really in Nicaragua, it really helped Cuba to, again, cross over that bridge of the attempted sabotage of their socialist project, right? And it was unfortunate Comandante Chavez passed, and once he passed, the attack on Venezuela went hard. They came after Maduro, they still after him, you know, every chance they can get to clamp down on friends that Cuba has and anybody who's thinking of their people and liberation, they will do it. And they're putting Venezuela through sanctions just like they put Cuba through sanctions. When I think about the Venezuela story, if people understood what it meant for Venezuela to now have doctors to attend to their population, people who are willing to go in the rural areas and the poor areas and take care of their people, not because, you know, they were getting paid billions of dollars or living in luxury. No, these physicians, nurses, techs were all going, and sometimes they have to, you know, share a couple rooms, but they have to go out there and take care of the everyday people because those are their brothers and sisters, you know, from another nation. And they did phenomenal things. Barrio Adentro set up, you know, the access to every to people having access to physicians and nurses in their communities. It then was scaled up to building, you know, more sophisticated clinical diagnostic centers. Then the Operación Milagro, which was a huge undertaking in curing a lot of people of blindness that was mostly due to preventable infectious diseases. And Cuba did that with Venezuela. And before you know it, there were more countries that needed Operación Milagro. And they took it all over the world. And it's just the history of Cuba and how we get here to Elam is a long one, but it is one of the underdog that keeps triumphing despite the odds being against it. And it just brings me to the point where, you know, Cuba is still very much under blockade, especially thanks to Trump, who, after Obama decided to, you know, reverse some things, Trump decided to reverse everything Obama did, and then some, because he was on a mission. He was going to pander to our friends in Miami and in the Cuban diaspora who do not want, you know, the good for the people of Cuba. He was going to pander to that minority at the expense of the Cuban people's livelihoods, their well-being. And so Trump did it, and then Biden, who we thought was going to reverse, you know, Trump's measures, decided to maintain it because he also wanted to pander to the Cuban minority in the United States. And it has really destroyed, you know, the time that I was there, the things that I saw and experienced that I felt like, wow, things are getting better. Everything has just gone in the opposite direction because of the measures. And to think, listen, I graduated in the year of the pandemic. I saw what Cuba was doing in 2020. And by the time I got here, I saw what the United States was doing. And I was livid. I was like, how is this possible in this country with so much resources? And we are not able to save over a million people from dying. Preventable deaths. And Cuba puts every penny it has in its coffers to creating 5 vaccine candidates and making sure they were safe enough to vaccinate children with first. And we're just, it's just, you know, it's something that, I don't know. All I know is when I got here and I saw the situation and I saw what they had Cubans go through in the pandemic, they wouldn't even let Cuban people buy parts for their ventilators during the pandemic. The U.S. government would not grant the license for Cubans to buy parts for their ventilators. They would not grant access. They even tried to stop a ship of a donation coming from China with masks and other protective equipment. Just everything. When it got to a point, even being able to buy syringes to be able to vaccinate the Cuban population became such a hassle that it was the solidarity activist movement that garnered the resources to get syringes to Cuba. These are not things that should happen in Cuba, because part of the story of triumph of Cuba is it's a place that, because it was left to fend on its own, decided to dedicate its resources to honing that capacity of development for self-sustenance, right? They developed their biotech industry to be able to make the 8 out of 12 vaccines, 13 vaccines that they vaccinate their children with every year. They developed a biotech industry that would be able to be the basis of pharmaceutical production in their own country, but they needed raw materials to make that happen. And guess who has a monopoly on raw materials in the world, in the market? Because the U.S. blockade stipulates that if any product has more than 10% component, it cannot be sold to Cubans. Let's think about that statement and the way that penetrates the market so deeply when it comes to products that Cubans can have access to. So yes, it's a blockade on every level. Now, financial transactions are being, you know, limited because they've also placed Cuba on a state sponsors of terrorism list, thanks to Trump and also Biden keeping it that way. State sponsors of terrorism, where? We know who's sponsoring terrorism. We're very clear on who's sponsoring terrorism here and abroad. But yet it's little Cuba, a small island of 11 people, that has to suffer this designation that essentially hinders everybody from doing business or having good relations with Cuba. Because we always keep saying this. People don't understand the market system is based on the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar and gold is what dictates the market, the global market system. So anybody that goes against that U.S. market system can be stripped of their livelihood. And it's a hard price to pay. What Cubans have gone through for over 60 years contending with this issue, most of us, my sister, I'm from Ghana. I don't think Ghanaian people would last 3 months with this kind of policy. It's something that is probably able to break anybody. But because the people of Cuba have been clear from the get-go, they did not want to be dominated by anybody. Not the Spanish, not the U.S., nobody. And they've been fighting that battle since. And it's unfortunate that in the same hour that, you know, Cubans fought for their liberation from Spain, Puerto Rico, Guam, Philippines, who am I forgetting? Hawaii, all of those got snatched up by the United States as territories. And we see how that has turned out, right? We see the parallel to compare what happens with Cuba, who manifests its liberation at a high cost, and what happens with those who don't manifest their liberation and still have to live under the boot of the empire.
Right. Yep. There's so much there. I'm glad that you mentioned South Africa. I was in South Africa maybe 2 weeks ago, and it's to your point, Cuba, for decades since the revolution, has not only supported liberation struggles and supported all the corners of the global South just in talks or rhetoric of solidarity, right? It's offered military support, like you said, and it's also offered medical solidarity. And I think that's a history that's not well known in this country, in the U.S., and very strategically, right? I think, you know, the first time I went to the island, this was maybe 2016, 2015. And it was, you know, there was so much excitement on the island around the lung vaccine development. And I remember just kind of feeling, you know, kind of embarrassed at, because I felt so confused as to, like, what do you mean a vaccine for a type of cancer, right? Like, I couldn't sort of understand. And I definitely couldn't understand how this small island was able to develop this, right? And that was then. And, you know, you mentioned the COVID vaccines that also sort of got global praise. And similarly, they also did distribution of these in mass. When, you know, vaccine distribution was also a sort of stage for the global north to hoard resources yet again, while people had to sort of fend for themselves and die because of COVID. So there's so many like threads that we can pull from. I think something that also comes to mind that I don't think people really understand, and I'm curious for you to maybe talk a little bit about, is we mentioned Palestine, you know, you mentioned being from Ghana, like the school itself being a hub for international students. But I think I was also surprised to learn, like, how many American students there is also in the school. You know, I think, like, the American chauvinism is very much so, like, the best and the most credible and legitimate institutions exist here in this empire. So when we learn that there's actually these amazing, brilliant students that are making the choice to leave the United States and go to, you know, a small island where they might not know the language, might not know too much, but see a sort of like value-centered approach to medicine and want to be part of that. But can you talk a little bit also around just like the presence of U.S. students in the school and sort of like, what does that mean? And yeah, what brings students from the U.S. to the school and to the island?
Yeah, so U.S. students have been attending this program since the first group got there in 2001, because Well, the history behind that was in the year 2000, there was a group of Congressional Black Caucus congressmen and women who visited Cuba with the help of Reverend Lucius Walker, the late founder of IFCO, Pastors for Peace. They visited the island. They saw, you know, Cuban healthcare system. They also got to visit Elam, and they saw, you know, these young people, bright from all over the world, being trained to be physicians. And one congressman from Mississippi, Benny Thompson, you know, made a comment. He was like, you know, people in the Mississippi Delta that he represents don't have access to enough doctors, and they are from poverty-stricken areas and would benefit from an education at an institution like Elam. And, you know, he wanted to know if it was possible for youth from Mississippi to study medicine in Cuba. Well, Cuba didn't give the response right away. A few months later, Comandante in Jefe came to the States for a UN General Assembly, and he gave a speech during that time in September of 2000 at the Riverside Church. Folks can look on YouTube for the live footage of that. And that's where he announced that scholarships would be given to U.S. citizens who come from disadvantaged, underrepresented communities here to study medicine in Cuba, simply because he was aware that, you know, that $200,000 debt that goes into pursuing medical school in the U.S. is very steep for those of us who don't come from well-established backgrounds. And so the charge became, you know, finding the youth that would be ready, who would meet the criteria and be ready to go to Cuba, study, and come back and serve their communities. Because that's the main stipulation with this scholarship, is that you are awarded a scholarship with the understanding that you will return to your home country and serve in the communities that need you. And so in 2001, IFCO was able to get some students down there who met, you know, certain requirements. Now the requirements are that you be between the ages of 18 to 25. Some exceptions are made for people up to age 30, that want to apply. You have to be a U.S. citizen. Unfortunately, we can't process green card holders. But when you do become a citizen, you can apply. And then also, you have to have a full year of college level sciences, being specifically biology, general chemistry, organic chemistry, and physics. So that those are the requirements at minimum for you to be to get an application and apply for the scholarship. And U.S. students have been there since 2001. To date, we have 228 graduates from the program. There are currently about 36 students on the island. That's the smallest number it's ever been. Because for a long time, it was always more students on the island and less graduates, right? But now the tides have shifted. We now have more graduates than current students. But it also is that over the years, we have the ability to fill 10 slots with U.S. citizens to study there. Most of the students who apply to this program and want to pursue medicine in Cuba don't know a lot about Cuba. There are some of us who, you know, through family or through different backgrounds, we've been exposed to Cuba a little bit. But most, like the average U.S. citizen, does not know much about Cuba or even the fact that you can go to Cuba to study medicine, right? That this is a viable opportunity. There are students, for our presentation, we turn the statistics on its head. When it comes to U.S. medical schools, there's only about, 4 to 5% Black and brown students in most medical schools. And then there is 2.7% Black physician force that is pretty much trained at four historically Black institutions in this country. At Elam, our U.S. delegation is 60% African-American. Then second is our Latinx brothers and sisters, about 30%. And then we have the last few Caucasian and a few Asian comrades. But we turn representation on its head. We are also predominantly female, as opposed to medical school here. Well, I think in general, medical schools always tend to have a little bit of more women now, but the issue is retention, right? And, well, retention is not an issue in the Cuban system. The women students do stay. Most of our professors are women in that system. It's actually quite amazing. Everything that you thought was impossible is very possible in the Cuban context. When you talk about people looking like you and, you know, being able to identify with, you know, the physicians who are teaching you, it's nothing like that in the States. Like, we know the professors here are mostly white men. Even if women have, you know, sprinkled their way through, they're still not the ones who hold, you know, high positions, right? So that's the reverse in Cuba. And Elam is really mirroring that kind of demographic. So it's really empowering to the point where, you know, for us U.S. students, like, when we get there, the culture shock is understanding that, you know, the world doesn't revolve around the United States. You have to learn to be a good neighbor with, you know, your comrades from other countries. But that is an organic process, right? If you are not somebody who is not willing to grow and understand, you won't have a problem. You will have a problem if you are rigid and if you are not understanding that, you know, unfortunately, we do have to unlearn the privilege and the imperial behaviors that we have acquired over time. But you're in Cuba, people treat you with love and respect. Nobody, you know, rages against you because you're North Americana or, you know, Estadounidense. Nobody's going to treat you bad because of that. Actually, I think it's the opposite. You know, unfortunately, that thing that oppressed people have of putting U.S. over everything still permeates in those spaces. And it's kind of frustrating, you know, because like you said, Cuba is its own potent power when it comes to, you know, learning and academics. But yet we will still feel like we got to look to a Harvard or whatever institution it is that's stateside. And it's like, why do we keep doing that? We have to unlearn that, right? That's something we have to learn. But the experience teaches you that those are the effects of centuries of programming that are going to also take centuries to deprogram and a concerted effort, right? U.S. students who are down there love it because, you know, we get to be bilingual by the time we come out of the program. We are much more able to relate to people of different social status than some of our peers who may have studied here or elsewhere, because medicine has always been like an elitist thing. Whereas we studied in Cuba and the janitor's kid could be your classmate. Like, it is what it is. You are working class represented, just like most of us, you know, come from working class families. So we see that in our Cuban counterparts, in our counterparts who are coming from other countries. And that's an empowering aspect of our living in that society. It helps a lot of us to grow. Some of us still take longer than others. I wouldn't say it's a perfect situation, you know, because like I said, it's unlearning a lot of things that have been built into our mindsets for a long time. But more often than not, you will be transformed positively. And if, even if you didn't appreciate it while you were down there, if you were raging against, you know, not having McDonald's or steak when you want it or whatever it is, by the time you come back to the U.S. and the reality hits you, you're going to wish you were back on the island where everybody cared about you. Because that's what Cuba is, you know, it's love, it's community.
Mm-hmm.
It's having somebody look out for you that doesn't necessarily have to know who you are, where you came from, and what your story is. It's just nice to you. And I think there's a lot of that lost in the world. And some of us get resuscitated when we get there.
Absolutely.
So it's nice.
No, I mean, just hearing you sort of walk us through like all these different elements of the history of Cuba's solidarity, of sort of Cuba's commitment and just like rigor towards actually embodying revolutionary love for people, you know, makes me emotional. It makes me miss Cuba. Last time I was there was May Day of last year. So, you know, and I think especially now, you know, I think people are starting to see, you know, maybe seeing some media and some news around Cuba and the situation in Cuba, and the Western media is really talented at sort of stripping the context and the culpability that this country and this government has in actually, you know, inflicting the problems that people are having on the islands, right? And they do this for everybody, right? But for the, you know, for the sake of the conversation, we'll focus on Cuba. But, you know, I think people are seeing like, wow, the situation's really difficult on the islands. And I think so much of what you offered us was grounding in being able to kind of like hold all the nuances and the realities of like, yes, the situation has been difficult, and those who go against empire pay a very, very, very high price, right? And we can look to not just Cuba, but we can also look to Haiti, right? And it's islands that, you know, were sort of bold enough and you know, sort of wanted self-determination and liberation. And because of that, empire continues to sort of keep them in, you know, punish them. But I think, you know, to all of the sort of stories and anecdotes that you shared, and also historical sort of lineages, I think it's, I don't know, it makes me think of sort of what is the responsibility of us in the West in sort of demystifying some of these things, and also in recognizing that it is a difficult moment for the island, right? You know, we're 4 years into this pandemic. You know, Biden hasn't done anything differently than Trump. It's, you know, probably Trump will take his second term later this year. And we know how the economic, well, it's not just an economic blockade, but we know how the blockade is impacting Cuba in all these ways. So I'm grateful to have just had this conversation, because I think people here in the empire, people of consciousness who are seeing all the inequalities and all the forms of injustice, not just in Cuba, but also here at home, right? We see it every day. So I guess my final question, you know, to sort of close us out is, yeah, what do you think, you know, people of consciousness here in the West should be up to right now? Like, what should we be keeping in mind around Cuba in this moment? What, you know, what are some of the things we should be looking out for, right? Because we know, like, the propaganda is going to be upping in this moment.
Mm-hmm. Yes, excellent question, because we have a lot of work to do, and we are the key to unlocking some of that potential, you know. I think number one is to strip ourselves of this silence that we have about ourselves as a population. And that requires, you know, us getting information, studying, and being aware of what the reality is. The mainstream media, we have all realized, cannot be trusted in any capacity to relay truthful information in real time, right? So this, between COVID and all that happened until now with this genocide, we have learned that the sources of information that we typically would look to and depend on for truthful information have failed us. And for me, it was important to see that, you know, there was a rise of independent media during the pandemic. And I really appreciate that because I was coming from, you know, Cuba, where I have all the information I need about what's happening in the world 24/7, newspapers, television news, you know. And then I'm coming here and that's not what I'm seeing, right? So I really appreciate that lens of independence that I found one way or another. And I think those, we need to get people hip on all of that for them to start consuming information and from sources that are healthier for us. Of course, I'm not just telling you to blindly believe everything you see or hear. You must question healthily, right? There's healthy skepticism, which is something that I also think we struggle with in this part of the world because we've been violated on so many levels regarding truth. So we lean towards questioning to the point where it paralyzes us. No, we question, we learn, but we need to find answers quickly and make actions immediately. Like, it needs to be a process. But for you to be better at that and build that muscle, you have to be constantly exposing yourself. You cannot be a person who's saying, oh, I'm apolitical, I don't get into this, and everything is political. Okay? I didn't sign up for this medicine to be railing against the system, but guess what? Who holds the levers of medicine? Politicians are the ones who are holding the levers of healthcare and how we deliver it, not only here, but in the world. So I have to be hip on that for the sake of myself and all of my community. And whatever sphere you are in, whatever work you do, you have to try and plug yourself within the bigger system, you know, not to feel isolated and siloed like how they want us to be. But we are connected in different ways. And how we do stay connected is being aware of our connectedness. And that requires constant study and awareness. I would implore people to engage with groups like the National Network on Cuba, with IFCO Passes for Peace, with the Alliance I think it's Cuban Engagement. I don't want to mess it up, but ACERE is the abbreviation. I'm going to look it up and tell you. But these are, just to start with, these are the groups that you can get to and get resources, information. If you want news about Cuba, Belly of the Beast is a great independent news source. Breakthrough News. You can find news in places. You can find information to educate yourself and your family members because charity begins at home. We have to help our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters understand what it is while we're in the streets educating random people as well, right? I know I did a lot of that when I came back. My family's pretty much calling me Comandante at this point because I had to lay down the law here. But we have to be engaged with the information and the truth. And we have to always keep our Cuban brothers and sisters in our hearts because they are going through hard times. And know that everything that we do, calling your representatives, telling them about Cuba and that they need to, you know, ease the restrictions on sanctions for Cuba and any other country that has been unjustly, you know, placed under sanctions. That's something we need to engage in. Not because it's some foreign policy that will never affect it. It affects us. It affects us. The fact that Cuba can live freely and do what it needs to do for its own people and for the world affects us. We don't have access to the Sinovac vaccine for lung cancer. We don't have access to Herbeprat that prevents amputations for diabetic patients. We don't have access to any Cuban product. Because that is bar. You don't even have access to Cuban cigars. I'm not a proponent for smoking. But for those of you who like it, you know, you're missing out. Cuban cigars are supposed to be, you know, a delicacy. Rum, all these things, you know, that are parts of Cuban culture and richness, we are barred from because somebody decided, no, it's not acceptable. And I think that the health aspect is what really kills me because science and medicine is always about collaboration, about putting our heads together to resolve problems. And that is the community that's really hindered. Culture. I was just learning that cultural artists are having a hard time getting visas to come here and have their performances. That's a huge that is a huge part of a huge population that has contributed to bettering relations, right? Artists. So if we don't have that free flow of artists between countries, what is that? How does that impact us? Severely, right? So there are things that we should think about in all spheres of our lives that we can help each other mutually from, and that is being hindered by this blockade. So I really would engage people to not stay silent, because silent will not protect you. As Audre Lorde said, we need to speak, not only about Cuba, but Palestine, about every egregious injustice in the world, Puerto Rico. We need to, everywhere that there's a people clamoring for something different, we should let them decide and let them have what they feel is adequate, right? We should not be interfering in everybody's lives while at the expense of people, you know, not having the full rights that they deserve right here in the United States. So many unhoused people. It just doesn't make any sense. People who don't have enough food to eat. And we are literally starving people in Gaza, in Havana, everywhere. It's like, I don't understand. What is the issue? There's so much for us, for every one of us to get a little bit of something. Why do we have to create these situations where there's false scarcity in our own stores here, and then just strangle people to the point where food aid is sitting rotting out because it has not been able to get to its destination in time? Those are critical elements of health that we need to pay attention to. Health encompasses your environment, your food, your nutrition, your safety, transportation. We know transportation is lacking in this country. Not everybody can get everywhere unless you got a car, and that's the whole thing. But all of this speaks to how we need to engage this topic of health, and how we need to understand that if I'm not healthy, if something's not right with me, you're likely to be impacted too, whether you know it or not. The pandemic was a clear, you know, example of that. In as much as some of us had the luxury to do certain things and while others didn't, it really made it clear how unequal this system is and how unjust it is, that the people who have to put their lives on the line are the ones who are least protected. And I think, you know, in light of what is happening in Gaza with the intentional decimation of, you know, healthcare infrastructure, of killing health professionals, journalists, you know, scholars, I always worry, you know, that even sometimes us highlighting these people who have died and who belong to these professions makes it seem like we are putting their lives as higher or more important than other people. And that's not it. They are all important. Everyone who has lost a life, from that 3-day-old baby who couldn't make it to, you know, the head of a university who put in, you know, decades in building a new cadre of scholars, they are all important. All of their lives are important. And we are just saying that in order for us to sustain a healthier world, we shouldn't have to target schools, hospitals, you know, places of worship. We shouldn't have to target the elements of life that really keep people alive. And the sooner we understand that we have to mobilize to stop that, I think the better on all fronts, because we may not be going through a genocide like Gaza is, but we have been going through a systematic decimation of important people and important elements in our communities decade after decade, especially those who have tried to, you know, set a different example. So we all need to be on guard. This is not the time, you know, to fall back and hide out. I've lost that. I'm just like, you know, what is the next move? I'm ready. And I'm hoping everybody will join in that kind of, you know, readiness, because it's going to take all of us to get us out of this situation.
Dr. Audre, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you for just like all your brilliance and your fervor, like that, like revolutionary fervor. I'm really grateful for you. And I'm excited for people to just know more about Cuba's contributions and sort of deepen their own commitment to the revolutionary struggle. Thank you.
Right on. It was a pleasure to be here. You know, we're not many, so the spaces that invite and engage in this kind of dialogue are really important to me. And I just hope they multiply and your listeners multiply, not only in number, but, you know, in how they are able to transfer that knowledge and that information to get through your podcast. And please, my love to you for, you know, being on here and doing yes. this, because it is a labor of love.
Absolutely.
You know? So we really appreciate
Thank
this
you.
Opportunity to share this story and reach a new audience.
Thank you.